Hi, this is Alan Chartok. With us today is former New York State Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch. Lieutenant Governor Ravitch has a new memoir coming out at the end of April called So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises. The new book tells the story of Ravitch's life, bringing together the stories of what he did, including colorful anecdotes about political leaders such as Ed Koch, Hugh Carey, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and explaining why so many of the lessons he learned are relevant to the serious fiscal problems facing the cities and states across the nation. Trained as a lawyer, Ravitch began his career in his family's construction business. He built high-profile projects like the Whitney Museum, but his primary energy was devoted to building over 40,000 units of affordable housing. Those endeavors ultimately led to a life of public service. After Governor Eliot Spitzer resigned in 2008 and New York State was in a post-financial crisis meltdown, Spitzer's successor, David Paterson, appointed Ravitch lieutenant governor and asked him to make recommendations regarding the state's budgeting plan. What Ravitch found was the result of not just the economic downturn, but years of fiscal denial. Despite his work in the political arena, Ravitch still has Emersonian faith in the ultimate goodness that political democracy can help America achieve. And he hopes that by writing about New York's near bankruptcy and the intricacies of how it was avoided, he can help many cities around the country that are facing the same prospect. Welcome, Richard Ravitch.
Delighted to be here.
So you've had quite a life. I really enjoyed the book. But what I really enjoyed about it were the vignettes about the characters. Because, you know, there were so many characters as we sort of came up. I mean, I have debated Ed Koch at least four major times on the radio. He turned into quite a conservative later on in his life. And Hugh Carey was quite the guy when he was here. So why don't we start? I'll give you a word, and then you tell me what the word means to you, okay? Oberlin.
The college that I chose to go to out of some mild form of rebellion when I was 17 years old, I thought the Midwest would teach me more about America than some New England ivory tower school, and turned out to be wrong.
Really? Because, you know, when I grew up on Fire Island in the summers, Oberlin was right up there with Harvard and Yale, was where all the Jewish kids' parents wanted them to go.
My parents were disappointed that I chose to go to Ohio. But actually, my father passed away my freshman year, which is one of the reasons that contributed to my going to Columbia. But it was the luckiest decision I made because I had, as I tried to relate in the book, an extraordinary educational experience there that shaped my life. And what I learned there from Dick Hofstadter and Lionel Trilling and Jack Barzin and David Truman.
Can you imagine?
Is what I still sort of, you know, those are the guideposts in my life intellectually about what I think about democracy and government and the values of our society.
Where did you live when you went to Columbia?
Well, I lived home the first year with my mother after my father passed away, and then I shared.
That was in Manhattan?
Yes, in Manhattan. And in subsequent years, I shared an apartment with a guy by the name of Bill Haddad.
Oh, remember him very well. And what was that like? What was batching it up with Bill Haddad like?
I had a girlfriend in New England at college at that point, so my life was somewhat circumscribed
by
that
fact. So on the weekends, you were gone.
But during the summer, when I worked as a construction laborer those summers, I had a good time.
Yeah. Were you a pig when you were a construction laborer? You know, many of those construction guys get a bad reputation.
No, I didn't. I stripped forms on the construction of the Einstein Medical Center one summer and stripped forms at an apartment house on 68th Street.
These are the forms that they poured the cement into?
That's correct.
Yeah. Interesting. Did that affect you in terms of your subsequent work in building so many projects?
No, but it taught me a lesson, and that is I found out that all the other laborers, I was a little self-conscious about the fact that I was a spoiled college boy and working with all these guys on construction jobs until I found out they all had newer and fancier cars than I did. That's when I first learned that Karl Marx was fully you-know-what.
Indeed, that was the prevailing attitude, I'm sure, among the blue-collar guys. What happened when the women walked by? Did you join them in the wolf calls and the whistles?
I can't recall whether I was actively doing things, but certainly I was thinking about it.
You went to Washington. What was that like? I remember my time there as an intern.
Well, I wanted to get a job on the Hill. I thought that was best way to sort of begin a life of public service, and I didn't know anyone and had no connections, And a friend who graduated a year earlier from law school told me the way to get a job on the Hill was to date the secretaries. So every time I got a pass from Fort Dix, I was a private in the Army, I would go down to Washington, and through some secretary I met an extraordinarily wonderful congressman from California by the name of Chet Hollifield, who gave me a job. Because in the course of interviewing me, he found out that I loved Franklin Roosevelt. And he went into politics because of Roosevelt. So we had Franklin D. Roosevelt in common.
Did he drink?
I don't think so.
Okay, because the congressman I worked for, who got abscammed later, he drank, but he was great. He was a great
was
man.
That?
Frank Thompson, Jr.
Oh, I knew Frank, sure. Great. He was in love with Chet Hollifield.
A great man. I loved him. So, Gene McCarthy.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
Gene McCarthy was an extraordinary man. He was the father of the idea that the way to break the logjam that was created by a coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans who prevented any civil rights legislation.
Judge Smith went apple picking.
That's correct. He created the idea of this new caucus in the House. And that's really where I spent most of my time working down there. And I got to know him. And as a result of that, even though I left the Hill and moved to New York, got married, went into business, I got very involved in Gene McCarthy's quest to be selected as Lyndon Johnson's running mate in 1964.
And what happened there?
Nobody could campaign openly for the job.
Sure.
Because this was a decision by only one man, President Johnson. And the two contenders, serious contenders, had to be, were the two senators from Minnesota, Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy, and they couldn't have been as different from one another as they were.
Well, so Humphrey had come up as a, quote, liberal lion, but by that time, McCarthy was the more liberal?
No. Interestingly enough, I remember McCarthy, the people who supported McCarthy in the party were the mayor of Chicago, the governor of Texas. He did not have the labor movement or the liberals supporting him in 1964.
Yeah, but he had the left.
Well, he did, as the anti-war campaign developed, yes. That's what he had. And Humphrey, of course, was loyal to the president. Whatever he may have thought of Vietnam, he was not outspoken on the subject, and that became the issue.
So he was really disappointed when the president had his aide call him and say he wants you to give the nomination speech for the other
guy.
Yes,
I was with Gene McCarthy in a motel room in Brigantine, New Jersey, when he got that call. He was very unhappy about it. And the next morning, the president's executive assistant ran into Gene in the hotel in Atlantic City and told him the president was very upset that Senator McCarthy hadn't been more eloquent and passionate about his endorsement of Humphrey. And Gene McCarthy's response to the president's assistance was, well, I think that the president's going to change the national anthem to Perdonalis Uberalis.
Oh, boy. Boy, I mean, that's the kind of thing with that guy. Frank Thompson used to call him initials, LBJ, could get you into a lot of trouble.
But he was a great President Johnson.
Oh, he was. He was, except for one major failing.
Yes.
When you were in the Army, tell us about that. You had one sergeant you really didn't like, and who didn't like you.
No, he didn't, because I ended up defending a lot of soldiers who got caught up in court-martials for various and sundry.
Now, did you already have a law degree?
Yes.
Okay. And so you were private, but you were defending these guys?
The Army rules and regulations permit somebody who is court-martialed to pick the lawyer to defend him from anyone and they wanted. So I got picked first by a guy who was a Port Authority cop in civilian life, and ultimately by a wonderful young man who was a photographer at the Buffalo Evening News.
We're talking to Dick Ravitch, who many of you will remember in his last post as lieutenant governor under Governor Patterson. So this business of building things, it's very interesting to me. You know, my mom built a Michelama project on 96th Street between Columbus and Amsterdam.
Which one?
It's the Riverside Neighborhood Assembly House. She was the head of the Riverside Neighborhood Assembly.
You're kidding. I built a lot of those buildings.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. So let's talk about Michelama because it's such an interesting subject. The original idea was what?
The original idea, New York State was always an innovator and trying to do good things for our society. And this was a concept of how to provide housing for people who weren't poor by the traditional standard of poverty, but who were middle class but couldn't afford to rent or buy housing in the open market. So it was this very simple subsidy program which enacted by the state, by an assemblyman by the name of Laba, and a state senator by the name of Mitchell, which provided authorized cities to grant real estate tax abatements to limited profit owners and developers, or to nonprofit owners and developers, and provided the benefits of tax-exempt financing by permitting the state itself through the State Housing Finance Agency or cities through their own respective housing finance agencies to issue tax-exempt bonds and in turn relend that money at what was obviously a below-market rate interest, which resulted in rents being substantially less than market rents generally.
You know, Pete Seeger once said, "Why are people so greedy?" I say that because Mitchell Lama is such a great case study of this. The idea was that when you were done and you had to move out, what did you do? You couldn't appreciate the appreciated money that your apartment was worth. But they didn't like that. They wanted to be able to sell them at the end.
Well, they weren't permitted to originally, but
that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yes, but it kind of eroded a little bit because of the politics.
So what happened is they all got together. They went to their assemblymen and to their people who were up in Albany and said, change it so we can sell it and make the profit, even though we've been given this terrific deal. And the whole idea was to sort of help the middle class get situated. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're absolutely right. 100% right. And then, of course, that morphed into what was Governor Rockefeller's favorite enterprise, the New York State Urban Development Corporation, which was used the same Mitchell Lama law to provide financing. The only difficulty was they were so eager to get it done, they didn't pay much attention to the accuracy of the numbers on which they predicated their loans.
So tell us a little bit about the UDC. You had to do with it, and what was it?
It was Governor Rockefeller's very intelligent and very admirable response to the urban crisis of the early 60s. And he said, in addition to providing tax abatements and low-interest loans, government's got to be more proactive. We don't want to just sit and wait until somebody comes to us and applies for a loan. We want to be out there and try to accelerate the rebuilding of the slums in our cities by becoming the promoter of these projects and the developer of these projects, and we'll hire private enterprise, but we want to be the determinant of what happens and who's eligible to live there. And it was a perfectly sound response.
But Dick Ravitch, was Rockefeller the greatest governor you knew, or was it Hugh Carey in your mind?
Hugh Carey.
Was it?
I have such extraordinary both respect and affection for you, Carey. Out of nowhere, I'd never met him. I had refused to contribute to his campaign in 1974, but he reached out to me and asked me to come in and help avoid the bankruptcy of UDC, which has changed my life.
It
and,
did,
and
indeed.
And we became very good friends and really close friends in the years after he left the governorship. But he was an extraordinary man.
You get a lot of credit, of course, for figuring this thing out with him. You know, I think I should explain to people who are listening now that you're one of those guys who is part of sort of the permanent infrastructure of our history. I mean, you are. And, you know, UDC, MTA, you name it, you were there. You're like the 2,000-year-old man. You were there for the whole evolution of all of this. But the UDC thing was real interesting because, as we all remember or should remember, there was a question as to whether or not New York State was going to stand behind the bonds and things that had been floated by these guys.
That was the question, and it was a very difficult question because, on the one hand, it was absolutely true that the state had some real obligation for the debts of its children.
And UDC, that was the debate, right? That was the debate.
That was the debate. But they were morally obligated, and they were not legally obligated. There is no question that had the issue ultimately been litigated, the state would not have had to do what the state did. But it was
because they weren't legally obligated.
That is correct.
Yeah.
But it was both Hugh Carey's values, which is government's supposed to turn square corners with its citizens, plus the fact that he was fully aware, we all were, that if we defaulted on those obligations,
so who's next?
The credit of the dormitory authority, of the state university, of New York State public housing, everybody's credit would have been impaired for a long, long period of time.
So, Dick Ravitch, can you give us a sort of insider's view of what it was like to be in the room when you were making decisions about this stuff?
It was fascinating. And I guess the most fascinating story of all was what happened after the UDC crisis had been solved.
Debated, yeah.
And I was back in my business. I was chairman, but I hired a very talented young man to be president and CEO. And I went back to my business and my family, who I hadn't seen much of for 3 months. And one day I got a call from the governor's secretary, Irene, who said that the heads of all the major banks were coming in to see the governor at 2:30.
I love this part of the book.
And you ought to be here. And I said, what's the meeting about? She said, I have no idea. I said, the governor asked me to be there. And she said, no, I haven't talked to him. I simply told the police detail that he's with. The banks were coming in, and he would meet with them at 2:30. So this is my idea.
Isn't that interesting, though, that the gatekeeper, the secretary, has all that power?
Well, she didn't have any power.
Well, she had the power to invite you or not invite you.
Well, you know, when you work as closely as I did with the governor and his staff for the previous 3 months, you get to know people. So I walked over there. The office was on 55th. My office was on 53rd. I walked over there with no idea what to expect. And the heads of the three major banks and the governor and I, nobody else in the room, and they told the governor that they were no longer willing to underwrite the notes and bonds of the city of New York. And there was a painful moment of silence. And I said, effective when? And they said, effective immediately. I didn't know what to say. I understood the unbelievable significance of this, but
what was the basis for their refusal? They just thought that by your undertaking to underwrite UDC and other things, that in fact you guys had been behaving irresponsibly?
No, I think they recognized that they'd been behaving irresponsibly, and they were no longer willing to take the risk of issuing more and more debt that the city had no chance whatsoever of repaying except by continuing to borrow. And that's why the city almost went bankrupt, because the banks in the previous 8 years had been lending an ever-increasing amount of money to the city every year. And when we fought with them on the UDC thing and said, you know, you've got to make sure we finish these 30,000 units of affordable housing, or we're not going to pay your notes back, we'll let them go into default, they caved. And they realized that for the first time, a governor was going to stand up to them.
Would Rocky have stood up to them?
I can't make that judgment. Probably at that point.
But Hugh Carey was the guy who...
But he was free.
He could have blood in his eyes.
Yes, you know, it would have been more difficult for Rockefeller to do that, but ultimately he would have had to. He would have had no choice.
I can't help but tell you that there were some issues with Hugh Carey that I know you're not going to like, but there was the famous dentist's house on the island that he lived on,
Shelter
Island, in which they're going to take down the guy's house because it blocked the view, but really because it was a security issue.
I have no recollection of that.
Oh, okay. You all made all the papers. It was a big thing. Dick Ravitch, so let me ask you about Wagner, one of my more interesting politicians in my life. How much did you have to do with him, Bob Wagner?
Very little when he was mayor. We became friendly in subsequent years, and he was also a terrific guy, smart as hell and thoughtful, and he gave me wonderful advice.
Like what?
Well, I remember when I became chairman of the MTA, we had lunch, and he said, you face a possibility of a real subway strike coming up, and I want to give you some advice, Dick. He said, if you put the public interest, which I know you will, ahead of your personal reputation, you'll get a better deal for the public if you're prepared to let the union leader look as if he won and you look as if you lost.
So give me an example of how that worked.
Well, it's a long story. It's hard to tell it in short form, but the night the contract expired, this was the following April 1st, which was the first night of Passover. In those days, the tradition was no contract, no work.
Sure. And who was the union leader then?
John Law, L-A-W-E, wonderful man who had been a bus driver and for the Fifth Avenue Coach Company. And he and I met the night before, and we worked out a deal whereby we would have a series of meetings the following night, the night that the contract was expiring, and that he would humiliate me in front of his executive committee, by getting me to agree to a deal that he insisted on, which was, of course, the deal that we had just previously negotiated. And then the following morning, I get a call from the governor, who's very concerned that the mayor and I are going to have a fight. So the governor says...
And the mayor at the time was...
Ed Koch, who, of course, had been very friendly with Hugh Carey because they'd both been members of Congress at the same time. I was perfectly friendly with Koch. He had tried to get me to become deputy mayor for economic development. And when Carey asked me to be chairman of the MTA, Koch called me on the phone and said, you got to do it. But at that point, Koch was making a big thing about the labor contract, the subway contract. So Hugh Carey decides that he's going to have a Passover Seder at the St. Regis Hotel for Ed Koch and me. And his son was the banquet manager at the St. Regis at the time, and who tells the story that they had never gotten gefilte fish before at the St. Regis Hotel. And they had a Passover Seder. And I knew I had this secret deal with a union leader that I didn't tell them. Wasn't going to tell the mayor because I knew he would blast me, and I had to make sure I had the votes on my board ultimately, but it all fell apart because the executive committee of the TWU was drinking so heavily, they told the head of the union to go to hell that night, so the strike began at midnight. The union leader called me at 1 o'clock in the morning and said, I'm terribly sorry, I couldn't pull it off.
We've had a change in the guard here in New York State. The teachers just kicked out their guy, who was a terrific guy, I thought.
Dick Iannuzzi.
And the Public Employees Federation, the second biggest union, he gets kicked out, but they always get kicked out. But the head of the CSEA, Danny Donahue, calls Governor Cuomo a monkey. And this, of course, gets a lot of raised eyebrows because they have to negotiate with the same guy. And I know there were people within the union who were furious at him for doing it. But he's the last man standing because he knew enough to tell his people, I'm going to really get in the face of this governor. What do you make of that?
I met Dan Donahue only once when I was up in Albany. I don't know what he...
But what about the strategy? I guess what I'm talking about is the strategy.
Well, I don't think you call people names. That's never useful.
Uh-huh. Well, it's useful enough to keep him in office, is my point.
Well, maybe. I don't know. On the other hand, Dick Iannuzzi publicly questioned whether it was an appropriate time to have a tax cut in the state of New York. And I wondered whether that had anything to do with the fact that he got thrown out.
So the Moreland Act, we've heard a great deal about Moreland Act commissions. So these are the extraordinarily powerful groups that a governor can appoint who can go investigate things. Tom Dewey did it. You experienced Moreland Act when you were advising governors. What was that like?
Well, actually, when Governor Carey asked me to chair the UDC, and I recognized that there were issues about the way my predecessors had acted. I don't mean that they acted immorally, but they were responsible for the insolvency and the lack of creditworthiness of UDC. And if you become chairman of a corporation that's not in a position to pay its debts, you have a responsibility to go back and examine it and bring lawsuits against the people who are responsible. I didn't want that. And I said to the governor, I will become chairman of UDC and deal with the future if you appoint a Moreland Commission to study why it got into the trouble it's in. Thus, the existence of that commission will give me the ability to say I'm not looking at the past or pointing the finger. I knew I had to deal with Warren Anderson, who was the majority leader in the state senate, a Republican, friend of Rockefeller's. I didn't want to be in the position of criticizing Nelson Rockefeller or any of the people he'd appointed.
Yeah. And how did that commission turn out?
Well-reasoned study report, which explained without political polemics why UDC got into trouble. Mm-hmm. But generally, the Moreland Commission is a useful device if it is used solely for the purpose of investigating the actions of, I thought, it was limited to the executive branch of the government. I didn't realize.
No, I think it. I think you're right.
Recently.
I think you're right in that. I think what happened is that the members of the Moreland Act Commission were all deputized by the Attorney General, so they then had the ability to ask the legislature and legislators questions. But you're right, I think, in your assumption. So I read in your book, your very good book, that when you were nominated by David Paterson, who I like a lot, to be the lieutenant governor, that Andrew Cuomo gave you some grief. Is that
true? No, he didn't give me any grief. The governor asked him, because he would represent the governor on this, and he, I was told, wrote the governor a memorandum. I never had a conversation with him. He wrote the governor a memorandum saying he didn't believe it was constitutionally proper for the governor to make an appointment of a lieutenant governor. And that's what led to Governor Paterson and his counsel, Peter Kiernan, hiring Kathleen Sullivan, who was an outside lawyer, to represent them, because they disagreed with the attorney general and thought that he did have the power. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals confirm that point of view.
I'm an old Cuomo watcher. I'm wondering, what do you think he was up to when he said no? Do you think he really believed that from a legalistic point of view? Or do you think that, he had a sharp knife out?
You know, there is no reason in the world why he should have had a sharp knife out for me. And I'm not even sure that at the time he wrote the opinion that he knew who Governor Paterson had in mind. So I can't properly suggest he had any improper motive. But I'll tell you what I do think. When Al Del Bello resigned as lieutenant governor...
Who can ever forget that?
And to Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo gave serious thought to appointing a lieutenant governor. Was advised by his lawyers at the time that it was a very close question. There was no way of being sure how the courts would ultimately come out.
Because this was not in the Constitution, the state Constitution.
That's correct.
Wasn't like the 25th Amendment. This is all different.
And under the law, in the absence of a lieutenant governor, the majority leader of the state Senate would have become governor had Mario not...
Had Mario gone out of town.
Right. And Mario didn't want to take the risk of offending Warren Anderson, who's... help he needed to get any significant legislation through by making an appointment and having it litigated. Plus, he didn't know the outcome. So I think that that probably had something to do with the attorney general's view. But I have no basis for believing that it was personal with respect to me.
Well, I've known Andrew for a while. I think it's almost always personal. We're talking with former New York Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch about his new memoir, So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crisis. Okay, so we're moving right along. You just mentioned Warren Anderson. I watched him very carefully for years when I was here. He had immense popularity with a lot of people on both sides of the aisle. Every once in a while, I talked to Fred Orenstein about him. He said, Warren and I... what would have happened if Warren and I weren't here, sort of self-serving stuff. So I'm wondering what you could tell us about Warren Anderson.
Well, I thought he was a terrific guy. Bright, able, honest, cared about what the right thing was. A politician, but to me, politician's not a pejorative phrase. It's a complimentary phrase.
But was he different from other politicians?
Well, I didn't know too many sort of upstate Republicans in my life until I'd gotten involved.
Yeah.
So... I can't tell, but he was a lawyer. He was an able guy. He was a straight talker, and you could talk candidly with him. Can I tell you one great story about Warren Anderson? At one point when I was chairman of the MTA and I needed to get the law changed because I realized I had to buy railroad cars, subway cars from abroad that were financed by the export banks of the countries in which they were manufactured, because I didn't have the money to pay cash for.
So it's about Japan.
And Canada and France. Yeah. And I needed a law change, the statute governing the MTA changed, which gave me the authority to negotiate instead of taking competitive bid. And the assembly, Stanley Fink, passed the bill like this. But Warren called me up and he said, Dick, he said, I have too many people in my conference who think that giving you the ability to negotiate contracts would give you the ability to raise a mammoth amount of money in the next gubernatorial election for Hugh Carey. And therefore, they don't want to pass your bill. So I said, Warren, would it help if you had copies of my disclosure statement, which only John Markey, as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, had. And I said, you'll see, I give no money to politics. I gave an insignificant amount of money to Hugh Carey. I gave him nothing in 74, and I gave him $500 in 78. So I'm hardly going to go and raise money at this point. So he said, well, you know, you don't have to do that, but we could try it. So I called Markey, and I said, release my disclosure. So I then get a call from Anderson inviting me to come up to Albany and meet with his conference. And they all had my disclosure in front of them. And there was an upstate Republican, whose name I forget, senator, bright guy, who looked at this and he says, oh, the only thing I can say after reading this is, Ravitch, you're a cheap. And a few hours later, they passed the bill.
Amazing. Do you think things have changed? We hear more and more about the blues versus the reds. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think the disincentives for good people to go into politics have piled up. First of all, half the press treats them all as if they're automatically dishonest or worthy of suspicion. The compensation is crummy, and the ideologues have enormous leverage in the process. And I just think that it's less and less attractive for people to go into politics, and we see that. And the legislature in those days was filled with people who were bright and able. Some of them went on to hold higher office and be very wonderful public servants. Some abandoned and went to the private world. So I think it's a terrible thing, because ultimately in a democracy, it is only politics that's going to bring about change, and only politicians we're going to engage in politics. And politics has become sort of a dirty word in many places.
Well, that leads to the question I want to ask you, Dick Ravitch, about ethics. We have a tremendous amount of interest now in revised ethics laws. Andrew Cuomo comes up with the Moreland Act Commission, obviously, to study the legislature. He comes up with something called J-COPE, which is an enhanced group to look at the ethics of politicians and others. Do you think it's a dirty place?
Look, I think there is no part of this world that doesn't have a couple of crooks in it. Business does, politics does too. I've never known of a crook in politics who doesn't ultimately get caught. And we've had several members of the legislature been indicted and convicted and are serving time or about to serve time. And that's very sad. But I have to tell you something. I think that in some politicians have chosen to make this an issue by lumping everybody together and suggesting that if a member of the legislature has a professional life and makes money at it, that that per se is a conflict. Whereas the founding fathers of the United States of America said in the Federalist Papers they wanted legislative bodies to consist of doctors and lawyers and businessmen and farmers. And the whole idea that there's something per se wrong or unethical about a member of the legislature having an economic life outside of government is absolutely outrageous.
Well, let me
it is all added to this mythology that somehow we need to have Moreland commissions looking into the private financial affairs of individual legislators.
Let me argue with you, because I do really feel differently. I think the whole thing is a big legislative process, a big meat market. And when Andrew Cuomo raises how much, by the time it's all done, it's going to be $50 million. And you look at who gave him the money, they're all people who want something from government. So
yes.
I don't like that. I think that that stinks.
No, I don't like that either. But that's, with all respect, a totally separate fact. The money is raised from the financial community, the real estate world, the unions.
You bet.
And they have agendas. When I was lieutenant governor, you know, outside of my office was a lobby full of lobbyists. They were all from those industries. They weren't doing anything unethical. They were doing something perfectly legal. The answer is a very simple answer. You have to reduce the influence of money in politics.
And you do that how?
By having public campaign finance reform. I am very proud of the fact that when I chaired the Charter Revision Commission for the City of New York in 1988, I wrote the first public financing law that has ever existed in the state of New York, and that has worked in New York City.
Sure has. Sure has. Don't you think that there are people, though, who would say to you that some of this is just unseemly. You say you agree with me, but you don't agree with me. But,
I don't think it's crooked to take a contribution from the real estate world. I'd like to see it fully exposed so that every governmental decision is known by the public, with the knowledge that if it favored somebody who'd written big checks to the governor or the mayor or the legislators, that was known. That's part of the decision-making matrix, but it's not illegal.
You know, you have an immense amount of inside knowledge. I had a show with Mario Cuomo for about 18 years once a week, and I wondered if you could offer us an analysis of the difference between the way you see young Cuomo running his government and older Cuomo running his government.
You know, I like Mario Cuomo. We have had a warm relationship in recent years, despite the fact that we had a very real disagreement when he became governor and I was chairman of the MTA, all of which is described in the book.
Yeah, he wanted to get more appointments to the MTA, right?
He wanted to change the law to make the chairman of the MTA serve at his pleasure instead of for a fixed term.
Sure, what governor wouldn't want that?
And the entire legislature told the governor not to send a bill up because there wasn't a single Republican or Democrat who would vote for it. And he took it out on me. But that's...
How did he take it out on you?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. It really didn't matter. But it affected our relationship for a while. But I see him and Matilda occasionally, and I'm very fond of him. And I've called him a few times to check some facts for my book. I've had no contact with Andrew, so I know only what the press reports.
Why is that? You're a major figure. You've contributed to the MTA, to the UDC, to building, to co-op.
You'd have to ask the governor that question, because it's not my role to offer gratuitous advice. If he wanted my advice, he'd ask for it.
Okay. So talk to me about some of the people that most people don't know about. For example, Larry Tisch. He's in your book.
Larry Tisch was a wonderful friend, a very smart businessman. Great capacity to understand business, and had a great sense of values, wonderful wife, wonderful children. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, they own a lot. They own movie theaters, they own hotels, they own a lot of different stuff.
He was self-made man, very successful, very smart. When I was asked by the FDIC to take over the Bowery Savings Bank, and I had to raise capital for that, I went to Larry Tisch, and in a two-hour meeting, he understood the deal and said, I'll invest the money.
How much? What are you talking about?
He was willing to invest it all. I had to raise $100 million, but all he could put up was $25 million, but he called Warren Buffett and introduced me to Warren Buffett, who invested $25 million also, and then I got money from other people.
So this is
Larry Tisch made it possible.
So this is the way things are done. In other words, you're a man of influence, you're a man of character. Who appoints you to be the head of the Bowery?
Well, the bank was broke,
right?
As many savings banks were, as a result of interest rates rising, and their assets were earning less than what they were paying for their deposits. So they were looking for somebody to run it who had a public reputation and who might be able. So we privatized it. We took it from being a mutual bank, which is a nonprofit institution, to being a stock ownership.
Mm-hmm. Did you make money?
I did. I did indeed. I did it in order to make money.
To make money.
Because after the better part of 8 years in public service, I had to replenish the coffers.
Somebody tried to kill you.
Yes. There were two attempts in my life.
Yeah. Because?
Well, actually, they never found either one. The police thought it was both crazy guys.
Crazy guy can kill you just as much as somebody
thought. No, because I raised the fare or...
You raised the fare at the MTA.
Sure. It was a scary experience. I had to wear a bulletproof vest for 4 years when I was in public. I had cops living with me. And it was not easy.
Was it something about
you? Exciting. I hope not.
You don't hear many stories about other assassination attempts. Here's a guy who plays an incredible role in government as a sort of the, you decided at one point to run for mayor, but you didn't do too well there. How come?
I was a lousy candidate.
Why? What defines a lousy candidate?
I think for several reasons. One, you grow up in a culture in which you're taught that modesty is becoming. If you run for office, you got to go out and tell the world you're the best thing since chopped liver. And that's hard to do if you grow up in a different culture. Number two, I worried too much about what would happen to my reputation if I lost. But the real reasons I did badly was that the race, when I first got into it at the urging of civil rights leaders and union leaders, etc., was well before Ed Koch decided to run again, which I don't think, and he and I became very dear friends in all these intervening years and had lunch and dinner frequently. He told me he didn't decide to run until David Dinkins got into it. And when David Dinkins got into the race in December, David and I are good friends, and we talk about this, or have talked about it a lot. We don't waste our time talking about it anymore. That it became a Koch-Dinkins race, and I had no serious role in it. But I had raised a lot of money. I had a lot of people volunteering to help.
You got 1% of the vote, right?
3%.
3%,
please. 3% in the primary. But I have to tell you something.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. No regrets about it. And I would have done it again if I thought that I had the ability to succeed in it. And I never thought I did. But I found it a wonderful experience, and it made me even more passionate about how wonderful politics were. People all over the city were gracious and nice. And I remember being in a very conservative church where everybody believed in the right to life, and I believed in a female's right to choose. And instead of being nasty, we engaged in wonderful debate and discussion. So I found it a terrific. I learned a lot about this city. In the course of those 3 months, I was at a subway station every morning, talked to people. I went to schools, birth control clinics, social organizations all over the city, and I was exposed. I mean, I had been as chairman of the MTA. I'd been around. I'd been to all 400 subway stations. But I had never seen the city from the perspective of being out there in social institutions and in the public talking with people.
So, Dick Ravitch, when you were the head of the MTA, you know, I get on the subways a lot these days. You know, not so good. I'm wondering, what are they doing wrong?
Well, I'm not sure they're doing anything wrong. I think that the classic issue that arose between me and Governor Cuomo in 83 is very different today. I think today the governor is in de facto running the MTA. And it's a perfectly legitimate way of governance. It's not the way that I chose. I viewed my responsibility to be to the public and to the employees, and I became an advocate. I thought that my job was to petition the political system to get money for the MTA. And I raised the fare.
How was that?
Well, it got a lot of people angry, but I'll tell you a great story. When the governor asked me to chair the MTA, about a week later, he and Mayor Koch had a press conference in which they announced that the fare was not going to go up for a year. About a week later, I go up to Albany for my confirmation hearing, and I asked State Senator to ask me whether there was any circumstance under which I would raise the fare. He said, Dick, we're going to confirm you. Why do you want to make trouble? I said, ask me that question.
You told him to ask you the question.
Yes. So he asked me, Mr. Ravitch, is there a possibility you could raise the subway fare? And I said, absolutely, if I didn't have enough money to run a safe system. And that, of course, was the headline. Ravitch contradicts the governor. The governor's staff was furious at me. Morgado didn't talk to me for months. I don't know, 6 months or a year afterwards, I'm at the mansion with Hugh Carey. And he says to me, you know, he says, I've been meaning to thank you for getting me off the hook. I never should have had that press conference, and I'm awful glad you said what you did. That's the kind of guy Hugh Carey was.
Yeah, but you hadn't cleared it with him, had you?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not. So, he did that all the time. And years later, I mean, you know, many years after he was governor, I continued my friendship with him and saw him frequently. He told me, he said, you know, he said, Dick, he said, I had the best of both worlds. If you had failed, I would have attacked you. If you succeeded, I would have taken credit. And sure. I succeeded in taking credit. And you gave it to me.
It's always been so.
It was the perfect relationship.
Tell me about the New York Times. There's a great Moynihan quote in the book.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, Pat Moynihan and I were very good friends.
Yeah.
And I think his family would say that I had a lot to do with influencing him to run in that Senate primary in 1976. And Pat was the, amongst other things, the darling of the neocons in many ways at that point.
I remember teaching out of his book, political science out of the book.
And after he got elected, there was a vote in the Senate which in effect was a vote on school busing, which was the controversial way that some courts had tried to enforce integration orders. And he voted for busing, having written on the other side of that issue for Irving Kristol's magazine at one point. So I asked him at lunch one day, I said, how could you have supported busing when you were against it? And he looked at me and he said, the New York Times, my boy, the New York Times. What did he mean by that? He meant that as long as he had the New York Times support, he would never have a primary from the left, which was the only risk he ever had politically, because no Republican was ever going to beat him, and he was never going to get a primary from the right.
Eliot Spitzer, sitting right where you're sitting right now, told us at one point that he really had grave reservations about public radio and television getting money from the government, because basically his view is, you know, if they give you money, sooner or later, they're going to want to pull the strings. And I think he may have had something about that. I mean, he may have been right. Certainly, that's been my experience. And so my question to you is, how essential is public funding for public radio and public television?
I think it's critically important. I think it's important for their survival, and I think their survival is critically important for the well-being of this society. As the print media is declining in force and effect because of all the things we're all knowledgeable about, the ways that people become informed are more varied than ever. Internet communication, television communication. Sure. And television news has become totally politicized. You watch MSNBC or Fox News, and there's a slant.
Well, there is, but you still have CBS and NBC, which have a lot more viewers than any of the cable stations do.
Yes, I don't know statistically. Yeah. But I think the economic pressure on the media business is such that it's very important to be able to have the kind of reporting that you get in public radio and public television, where I find many points of view are reflected. There's more serious reporting about complicated subjects. So I think it's critically important. And I think the fact that the Tea Party types want to cut out the funding tells you why it's so important that we not.
So let me ask you this. There's a very good chance, according to some of the major analysts, Nate Silver and other people, that the Republicans are going to take the Senate. What would that mean for the United States if the House of Representatives was the way it is now? It's certainly a very conservative institution. The Senate goes Republican. What happens?
I think as long as there's a Democratic president in the White House with the veto power, that they will never have enough, even if they get control, they won't have enough votes to overcome a veto. So I think you're going to have a tragic stalemate for 2 years, but I don't think they can do great damage. And I have to say, and this is what my book is really about in many ways, that there is a growing disconnect between what happens in Washington and what's happening at a state and local level. It's perfectly legitimate for a guy like Paul Ryan to worry about the size of the federal deficit. It cannot grow infinitely. And I think responsible Democrats recognize that also. But if what they cut is revenue that is critical for state and local budgets, then they may be just shifting a burden from the federal tax base to state and local tax bases. And what you're going to see is a growing bifurcation between the Republicans on the Hill and the Republicans in state houses around the country, because their interests are not totally consistent.
We just saw the speaker give a little bit of hell to the right-wing Tea Party-type Republicans. Do you think that's the look of the future, that the Warren Anderson types of the day will stand up and...
Yes, sir, I believe that.
Yeah, interesting, because it's just too much otherwise. We only have a couple of minutes, so I just want to ask you a little bit about your experience as the lieutenant governor. Did you like that?
You know, it was probably one of the least useful year and a half I spent my life. It was very interesting. I learned a lot. I didn't feel that I added much to the process of governance.
You ever have to go in and break a tie vote?
Never had to break a tie vote. Had a very nice relationship with most of the senators. My office was right off the Senate floor. I didn't spend a lot of time presiding at the Senate unless there was a particular reason to do so. There were issues on which I had, like housing and public finance, where I had some competence, where people reached out to me and I was able to be helpful to the housing commissioner occasionally and some mayors around the state. But the only really substantive thing I did failed, and that is I made a recommendation as to change the budget process. And other than Shelley Silver, nobody else was interested in it for whatever set of reasons.
Why did Shelley Silver?
Including the governor.
Why did Shelley Silver go along?
You know, he had a staff. And the guy who ran it, who was now the New York City budget director, was an unusually bright, able guy, and he saw the virtue in this. I think he believed that I was right, that we were, state was on an unsustainable fiscal course, which it still is, I might add.
So Shelley still doesn't get a lot of credit for that kind of thing, does he?
No, but he was willing to consider this seriously. Had some very good talks with him about it.
Well, we've been talking with former New York Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch about his new memoir, So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises. Richard Ravitch, terrific to have you with us. I hope you'll come back.
It's a pleasure. Really, am I asked such interesting and intelligent questions, so it's a real pleasure to be here.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.